Chapter 11. This was not Rousseau's time, but he could be heard clashing his keys some way off, and he had two soldiers with him. Their boots echoed in the long vaulted passage. Stephen made the necessary signal to Jack, who backed out of the privy, brushing the brick dust from his hands.
"Dr. Maturin, if you please,"
said Rousseau in the open door, and cocking his ear towards the farther room.
"How the young gentleman does sing, to be sure. You would say a canary bird." "Mind your step, sir," he said at the coffin turn.
"Wait here a minute," said the governor's secretary at the bottom of the stairs, and as Stephen stood there between his guards, he heard voices raised in disagreement on the far side of the governor's door. Most unfortunately, the soldiers and the turnkey fell to discussing the weather. Fine, but perhaps too fine. Perhaps the prelude to a storm, certainly the prelude to a storm. But even so, he gathered that the governor was uneasy about some irregularity, and that his interlocutors were trying to overcome his objections by reason, persuasion, and hectoring. They reached a compromise.
"He is to be returned before the closing of the gates, and both of you must sign for him," said the governor's weak, anxious voice. And then, "Come in."
There were not two men with him, but three, all soldiers. A big, burly, full colonel with a red, ill-tempered face, presumably Hector, a nondescript captain, and a dark, intelligent-looking lieutenant in the sombre uniform of the artillery. As he walked in, Stephen said, "Gentlemen, good day." The governor and the lieutenant replied. The captain moved his lips. The colonel merely stared. A clerk brought papers. The colonel and the captain signed. The lieutenant said to Stephen,
"This way, if you please,"
and they walked to a carriage in the courtyard. The workmen had made great progress since last Stephen saw the entrance to the temple, and now that the outer bailey was gone, he would not have known the place but for its position. The covered ways traversing the moat now stood open to the sky, and the gatehouse itself was no more than a disordered heap of stones, being carried away by a long file of carts. After some disobliging remarks about the awkward old sod,
"Civilians always the same. They want their ass kicking, just like natives. A whiff of case shot every 3 months,"
which seemed to be directed at the deputy governor, the colonel and the captain talked about their private affairs with a brutal, truly military disregard for their companions. The two were evidently related, a certain Hortense being the wife of the one, sister to the other. But even if their conversation had been much more interesting, Stephen was far too taken up with his thoughts and with observing their route to pay real attention. They crossed the river by the Pont au Change, as though their destination were the ill-omened Conciergerie. But the loud metallic voices never ceased discussing Hortense, and presently they were driving towards Saint-Germain-des-Prés.
"It will be the Rue Saint-Dominique," said Stephen to himself. "Even worse."
At the height of the abbey, the colonel stopped the coach and told his orderly to fetch a parcel from one of the little shops behind, and it was just as the man was coming back that Stephen saw Diana. She was in an open carriage talking earnestly to another woman, an over-ornamented woman he had never met. She was bending forward to the front seat with that peculiarly supple grace that he would have known at any distance. And now they were not 6 feet apart. He instantly shielded his face with his hand and watched her through his fingers. She looked well, though her face was grave, surprisingly well, straight-backed, slim. He did not recognize the arms of the carriage door, nor the rather flashy liveries of the footmen behind. The carriage was passed in a moment, but as the soldier's coachman moved out into the stream immediately afterwards, he had it in view for quite 10 minutes, and from time to time he saw Diana's companion, who sat with her back to the horses, a woman on the edge of middle age, dressed in the height of fashion, or perhaps a little above it, good-looking in a hard, determined way, a fair example of the Napoleonic court, not Diana's style at all, at all. The carriage turned off some way short of the Hôtel de la Motte to a large, newly painted house that had belonged to the Princesse de Lamballe. It was only when he had perceived and noted this that he found how strongly he had been moved. His knees were trembling, his breath came short against the beating of his heart, and if he had been addressed, he could hardly have answered in a natural voice. He mastered these outward symptoms quickly enough, but his mind was not fully at his command before the coach wheeled in under a covered archway. He had not even taken an exact account of their turnings, and he was not sure where they were, though it was probable that this building and its courtyards backed on to the Rue Saint-Dominique. Fortunately, they put him into a small, empty room for a 2 hours' wait, a traditional measure to increase anxiety and distress, and as he collected his wits, his emotion died away. The place was obviously military. Quite apart from the soldiers moving about in the courtyard, there was a kind of scrubbed squalor common to all armies he had ever known. Conscript hands had no doubt whitewashed the lumps of slag bordering the paths and the wooden post against the pockmarked wall, but no swab, no brush, had ever been applied to the filthy chocolate-coloured paint within. Nor, he reflected, would any navy, even the French navy, tolerate the unwashed glass, the fetid smell, the general seediness. At one point he heard screams, but whether they were genuine or false he could not tell. Such things were not an unusual prelude to an interrogation. The same seediness, the same contradiction, was apparent in the room to which he was led at last. Some of the officers were particularly gorgeous, but they sat at rickety, unpainted tables, and they had remarkably dirty, dog-eared files before them. These tables formed three sides of a square, and Stephen was told to sit on a bench that made the fourth. It was rather like the arrangement for a court-martial. What would have been the president's seat was filled by the colonel, who was so fond of kicking civilians' asses. But he looked discontented and bored, and Stephen had the intimate conviction that he was a nullity, of use partly for his rank and partly, if the army intelligence people were half as subtle as their political colleagues, to induce a man under interrogation to underestimate his enemies and so betray himself. The man in real control was a major in a plain undress uniform, a man remarkable only for his cold, deep-set eyes. He said,
"Dr. Mathurin, we know who and what you are. But before we deal with the matter of your colleagues in France, we have a few questions to put to you."
"I am fully prepared to answer any questions within the limits, the narrow limits, of those that may be put to an officer who is a prisoner of war," said Stephen.
"You were not a prisoner of war when you were last in Paris, nor were you here in the character of an officer. But leaving that aside for the moment, you are nevertheless required to give an account of your movements. Let us begin when you were the surgeon of the Java, captured by the American Constitution."
"You are mistaken, sir. A glance at the Navy list will show you that the surgeon of the Java was a gentleman by the name of Fox."
"Then how do you explain the fact that the description of the surgeon fits you exactly, even to the marks on your hands?" asked the Major, taking a paper from his file. 5'6", slight build, black hair, pale eyes, muddy complexion, 3 nails on the right hand torn out, both hands somewhat crippled, speaks perfect French with a southern accent."
Stephen instantly realized that this must have come from a French agent in the Brazilian port to which the Constitution had taken them, a man who had seen his coded documents and who had evidently taken him for the Java's surgeon. An understandable confusion, since he berthed with Fox and their captured dunnage had been jumbled together. The essential point was that the Major's paper did not come from Boston, where Stephen was known only too well. It was perfectly possible that even with this lapse of time, his doings in the States were unknown to Paris. Communication was irregular, as irregular as the Royal Navy could conceivably make it, and in killing Dubreuil and Pontécanet he had, after all, destroyed the Frenchmen's chief sources of information. If the strings of their net were as tangled and out of date as this, he might hope to elude them altogether. Looking down to conceal any gleam of triumph that might show in his eyes, he said that he could not be held responsible for any man's description, and that he must decline to comment. The description was handed about, and in the interval an orderly brought a small book covered in brown paper. Its size was exactly that of the Navy list. Having consulted it, the Major continued without any change of expression.
"You are a linguist, Dr. Mathurin. I dare say you also speak Spanish?"
"Catalan," murmured his neighbour.
"The various dialects of Spanish?"
pursued the Major, frowning.
"You must forgive me," said Stephen. "I do not find the question falls within the limits I have mentioned."
"Your reluctance to answer is significant. It amounts to a denial."
"I neither affirm nor deny."
"Then I think we may take it that you are fluent in Catalan."
"On the same basis, you may state that I know Basque or Sanskrit."
"Let us pass to the Baltic. What have you to tell us of the murder of General Mercier at Grimsholm?"
Stephen had nothing to tell them of the murder of General Mercier at Grimsholm. He admitted that he had been in the Baltic aboard the Ariel, but when asked what she had been doing there, he said,
"Really, sir, an officer cannot be expected to betray the warlike movements of the service to which he has the honour to belong."
"Perhaps not," said a man on the left, "but you can be expected to account for your presence there. Your name is not on the Ariel's muster. Her surgeon was a Mr. Graham."
"You are mistaken. My name is on the supplementary list after the Marines as a passenger, born for victuals but not pay or tobacco."
"As a goddamn spy," muttered the colonel.
Asked why he should choose to take passage for the Baltic of all places, he said that he wished to visit the northern birds.
"And may we ask what birds you saw?" said the Major.
"The most noteworthy were Pernius apivorus, Haliaetus albicilla, Somateria spectabilis, and Somateria mollissima, to whom we are indebted for the eider down."
"I will not be trifled with," cried the colonel. "Birds, eider down. By God, he needs a lesson in respect. Send for the provost marshal."
"There really are such birds, sir," said a red-haired lieutenant. "I do not believe he means disrespect."
"Kick his ass," muttered the colonel, moving angrily in his seat.
"Do you expect us to believe that you travelled 1,000 miles to look at birds?" asked another officer.
"You will believe what you wish to believe, gentlemen," said Stephen. "That is the almost invariable human proceeding. I merely state the fact. I am not unknown as a natural philosopher."
"Just so," said the Major. "And this brings us to Paris. Here we are on surer ground, I am afraid, and here you must expect to be pressed for satisfactory replies, for you were not protected by the laws of war. I strongly advise you not to compel us to press you to the utmost. We know a great deal, and no equivocation will be tolerated."
"I was protected by a safe conduct, delivered by your government."
"No safe conduct covers spying or collusion in treasonable activities. At Beauvilliers' hotel you received the visit of Delarue, Fauvet, and Hersan, all of whom desired you to carry messages to England."
"Certainly," said Stephen, "and I could name many more who did the same. You must know, however, that I steadily refused their requests, and that at no time did I deviate from my neutrality as a natural philosopher."
"I am afraid that is not exact," said the Major, "and I can produce witnesses who will confound you. But before doing so, I must have the names of your colleagues here. Come, Dr. Maturin, you are a reasonable man. You must know the importance the Emperor attaches to Grimsholm and to your sources of information. You will not oblige us to go to extremities."
"You are asking for what does not exist. I repeat, with the utmost possible emphasis, that during my stay in Paris, I never departed from a scrupulous observation of neutrality as a natural philosopher."
A single statement of the truth might have no great immediate effect, particularly in an atmosphere of such suspicion and duplicity. But its strong, unvaried reiteration, delivered in a tone of complete sincerity, compelled, if not total belief, then at least a suspension of incredulity. Several of the officers put forward objections, advancing names, some true, some false, of those who wished to communicate with England, and again in their questions and in Stephen's replies, "natural philosopher" recurred, like the refrain of a tediously repetitious song.
"Natural philosophers," cried the colonel at last. "Natural philosophers, my ass! Whoever heard of half Golconda being offered for the release of a natural philosopher, which is all he says he is? 100,000 louis! Balls! Of course he is a spy!"
There was a very short but very awkward hiatus, in which the colonel, mistaking the cause, corrected his louis d'or to Napoleon, The Major darted a steely glance at him and called out, "Bring in Monsieur Fauvet." Fauvet came in. He looked unbelievably mean, and the blustering, confident air he gave himself did nothing to improve it. He was accompanied by a fat man, tight in his civilian clothes, a man called Delaris, whom Stephen had watched before now, a man high in Lorry's organization, operating from the Ministry of the Interior and the Conciergerie. He had never knowingly seen Dr. Maturin, and now he stared at him with a naked, avid curiosity.
"Monsieur Fauvet," said the Major, "pray repeat your statement."
Fauvet did so. On various occasions, Dr. Maturin had offered to carry messages to England. He had spoken disrespectfully of the Emperor and had predicted his early defeat, had advised Fauvet and many others to make their peace with the King while there was yet time, and had solicited a substantial fee. Fauvet was prepared to swear to this. His voice was mechanical and unassured, a very wretched witness.
"What have you to say?" asked the Major.
"Nothing whatsoever," said Stephen, "except that I have never seen such a contemptible exhibition. I am surprised that even a civilian can sink so very low."
Delaris whispered in the Major's ear.
"No, no. No question of it," said the Major. "You will have to arrange that with the Temple if you can. For the moment he belongs to—"
Stephen did not catch the name of his owner, but it produced a considerable effect on Delaris, who gave a low whistle. Their conversation went on for some time, in an even lower tone, but Delaris's insistence and the Major's steady negation were clear enough.
"That will do for the moment," said the Major aloud. "Dr. Maturin, you will reflect upon what I have said. You have already been confounded on one important point, and at your next interrogation you may be confronted with still other witnesses. Do not flatter yourself with false hopes. We know far more than you can imagine. When next you are brought here, you must be prepared to speak with greater candor or to take the consequences, which, I am obliged to tell you, will be terrible for you and your friends."
The Judas-haired lieutenant, who had asserted that Ida Duck did in fact exist, took Stephen back to the dismal room where he had waited. He remained there, looking out of the dirty window that gave on to the broad, open court, and after a while he said,
"I was at your lecture, sir. Allow me to say how much I enjoyed my evening. May I offer you a cigar?"
"You are very good, sir," said Stephen, taking it and drawing the smoke in greedily.
"It grieves me extremely," said the lieutenant, "to see a man of your eminence in such a position. Let me beg you, sir, for your own sake and for the sake of your companions, not to persist."
A troop of soldiers marched into the court, halted, dressed by the right, grounded their muskets with a single crash. A bent man in shirt and breeches, his arms tied behind his back, was led, limping, from another gate and attached to the whitewashed post. His face, where it was not bruised and tumefied, was a yellowish-green. He was another man Stephen knew, who did not know Stephen, a double agent who worked for Arliss, a mercenary man, but now he looked steadily at the firing squad with an expression that raised him very high. At the given word, the muskets fired. The face burst apart in a red horror. The body jerked with extraordinary violence under the impact and then hung limp, still tied to the post. A young soldier turned, unseeing, to Stephen's window, appalled and white, and dropping his musket, he vomited on the ground.
"If you persist," the lieutenant was saying, he was obviously accustomed to these scenes, "you will be shot. If you make just a few concessions, it will be Verdun, and a reasonably pleasant confinement, no more."
"I am deeply concerned at what you tell me," said Stephen, "and believe me, I appreciate your kindness at its full value. But alas, your argument is based on a false premise. There are no concessions to be made, no secrets to be revealed."
On the way back to the Temple, the lieutenant, his only escort now, repeated his appeal in various forms, and Stephen repeated his reply. But he had seen this form of manipulation used so often that in time his answers grew a little short, and he left his companion with a sense of relief.
"How was it?"
asked Jack anxiously.
"Sure, it was no more than an ordinary interrogation, and they feeling their way," said Stephen, sitting down and smiling at them. "At present they are all to seek. Long may they remain so. Amen, amen, amen."
Amen,
said Jack, searching his face for signs of ill-treatment, and finding only a desire to say no more.
We have kept you your dinner, said Jagiello, and all the wine.
You are the jewel of the world, Jagiello, said Stephen. I could eat the best part of an ox, I find, and drink oceans dry.
He ate voraciously, and eating, he asked, with a nod towards the privy, How do we come along?
We scarcely had the heart to do anything with you away, said Jack, but if only I can get a solid purchase on the outer slab, I do not think the other should resist us long. Stephen, what is the French for a double sister block, coked? With a pair of them and a proper holdfast, I could raise the temple.
A double sister block coked? The deer alone can tell. I do not even know what it is in English.
Then I shall have to try to draw it, said Jack. Without a purchase, that slab will never shift.
Do that thing, my dear, said Stephen. For my part, I am going to sleep.
Sleep he needed, being very tired. But far more than sleep, he needed silence for the ideas to turn freely in his mind and form a reasonable sequence. It was clear to him that his adversaries, or someone behind his adversaries, were working on an intuition, no more. Their pieces of solid information were fragmentary. They did not link together. The Ariel had been in the Baltic at the time Grimsholm was given up. She was the kind of vessel used for such a mission. Maturin was in her. There was something odd about Maturin, and therefore a possible connection. During his visit to Paris, some one of the services, presumably Delaïs's, had tried to compromise him as a matter of routine precaution, but Stephen did not think that Fauvet's words had carried the least conviction, and he knew that neither Delaïs nor the Major could bring forward a more persuasive witness. But there was the Colonel's outburst. Although hitherto their manoeuvres had been rather commonplace, some of the soldiers were clever men, yet he did not believe they had prompted the Colonel's words. The words were spontaneous, a genuine gaffe, and the implication chilled his heart. Golconda meant great wealth. Who could conceivably have offered half Golconda for his release? It was possible that some of his friends might have made interest with the ministry on his behalf once his capture was known. Larre, for example, or de Puytren. But Larre was perhaps the most virtuous man he had ever known. In spite of a large practice and unrivalled opportunities for corruption, he was extremely poor, and boundless charity would always keep him so. De Puytren was becoming rich, but even if such a wild step should ever occur to him, which was inconceivable, he could not possibly command such a sum as 100,000 louis. There was no one he knew in Paris who could do so. No one apart from Arlis, his colleague in intelligence, who controlled far greater amounts. But such conduct on Arlis's part would be unthinkable. It would be against the cardinal laws of intelligence. None of his colleagues would do so, he was certain. Not only would it be entirely against the laws of the service, but it was also against those of common sense, an offer dangerous to the proposer, mortal to the beneficiary. In the history of intelligence, no innocent natural philosopher had ever been rated higher than a protest, no agent more than an offer of exchange. Half Golconda, any fraction of Golconda, was an open confession of his value and his guilt. He could hear Jack and Jagiello working at the stones with a far greater urgency, a steady, discreet rasping, for in spite of the thump and crash of the workmen not very far away, they dared not use hammers even by day, far less in the darkness. Twice the light of the patrol passed along the Judases. His ideas grew confused, rising and falling like the waves of the sea. Golconda and Golgotha merging into one another, Diana's name and image appeared in his mind. He was faintly aware of Jagiello covering him with another blanket, and then no more, until they shook him awake in broad daylight.
"They have come for you again," said Jack.
"Let him swallow a bowl of coffee quick," said Rousseau in the doorway with his soldiers.
Stephen gulped it down, slipped his glass ampulla into his cheek, tied his neckcloth, and he was ready. He had lain in his clothes, and he presented but a scruffy appearance as he walked into the governor's office. It was not elegant officers who were waiting for him there, however, but a solitary figure, the almost equally unkempt Duhamel, who gave him a civil good day.
"I am come partly on my own account and partly as a messenger,"
he said. Stephen was a little surprised at the humanity of his tone, but he was perfectly astonished when, after a certain hesitation, Duhamel went on to speak of his bowels. They had never been the same since Alençon. The medicines the French physicians had given him had nothing like the comfortable effect of Dr. Maturin's red draught, and he begged he might be told its name. At the end of a purely medical interlude, Stephen prescribed for him. Duhamel made his acknowledgments, and the atmosphere took on a completely different nature.
"I now speak for my principal," said Duhamel in a low voice, moving Stephen to the window embrasure.
A pause.
"As you are aware, the war is no longer an uninterrupted series of victories for the Emperor. There are very highly placed men who feel that a compromise, a negotiated peace, is the best means of avoiding useless bloodshed, and they wish their proposals to be carried to the King and the English government. These proposals can be carried only by a man who is trusted by those in power, and who has access to their chiefs of intelligence. It seems to my principal that you are ideally suited for the part."
"What you tell me is of great interest," said Stephen, watching Duhamel's face with the keenest attention, "and I most sincerely hope that your principal's project may succeed, that France may be spared as much as possible. But I am afraid I am not your man. As I was telling your friends at the Rue Saint-Dominique," here he perceived a glow in Duhamel's eye, "I am a mere naval surgeon, not even a commissioned officer. It is true that I have a certain notoriety as a natural philosopher, but that does not give me access to the great, still less to their chiefs of intelligence. There appears to be a most unfortunate misapprehension on this point." Duhamel's face betrayed a certain inner amusement, but it became perfectly grave when Stephen went on. "Besides, my dear sir, would the man your principal takes me for ever be so foolish as to admit his identity? Surely he would be utterly unworthy of the confidence of either side if he were to fling himself into the arms of the first agent provocateur that accosted him, if he were to enter upon such a very extraordinary undertaking without surrounding himself with equally extraordinary guarantees. It would be mere self-murder. The man would be an ass."
"I fully take your point," said Duhamel, "but for the moment let us presume that such a man were found. What kind of guarantees do you suppose he would require?
Do you think it really useful to discuss these remote hypotheses? If you were to ask me about the tertian ague or the osteology of the cassowary, I could give you a reasonable answer, but the mental processes of this merely conjectural being... I'm afraid you must have embraced the soldier's wild notion. In spite of my denials, they seem convinced that I am, how shall I put it, a secret agent."
"Yes, yes, of course," said Duhamel,
drumming his fingers on the packet he held in his left hand. He was very much master of his countenance, but even so the extremity of frustration now showed through, and in the long interval before he spoke, Stephen became more nearly persuaded of his good faith.
"I will put the position to you quite plainly," said Duhamel. "My principal's organization was convinced of your identity as soon as your description reached Paris from Brest. That is why you were lodged in the temple.
May I ask whose prisoner I am?"
"What's in a name?" replied Duhamel with automatic caution,
and then relaxing,
"Ours, for the moment. But to resume, the intention was to invite you, or shall I say the man you are supposed to be, since I see that our conversation must remain upon that level, the intention was to invite you to undertake this mission much earlier, when there would have been time to surround it with all possible guarantees. But the Emperor delayed his departure, and there were other difficulties. In the meanwhile, Madame Gross appeared at the Prince de Bénévent's ball with a most prodigious diamond, a blue diamond, and at the meeting of the Great Council the next day, her husband proposed that you should be released, displaying a sudden love for learning and a sensitivity for international scientific opinion."
Stephen felt himself grow pale, and he turned aside to hide it. Of course, Golconda was not only a general term for wealth, it was the name of the Great Mogul's diamond mine.
"Gross is no fool, except where his wife is concerned.
He made a very able speech, the international character of science, Cook's and Bougainville's immunity, and so on, and he very nearly gained his point. But in the end it was decided that the matter should be referred to the Emperor. Now the proceedings of the Great Council are not much more secret than those of your cabinet. Your value became obvious to various other bodies, and they are competing for the possession of your person. The army is particularly insistent. This, too, is to be referred to the Emperor. He is to decide between the claimants. And since the army connect you with Grimsholm, he is furious about that affair, they are likely to succeed. Their messenger is on his way, a particularly influential officer.
Did Madame Gross give any account of her diamond? Asked Stephen.
Oh, some poor thin tale of an inheritance, said Duhamel, brushing that aside. But I must tell you, you are in the greatest danger. Quite apart from anything else, if the Empire falls, or even if it looks as though it were about to fall, there are men who are determined that nothing shall survive it, men who will kill without hesitation and bring everything down in the same ruin. My principal has the Emperor's order for your release.
How can that be? The Emperor is in Silesia.
Come, come, Dr. Maturin, said Duhamel impatiently. You know very well how your Sir Smith escaped from this very temple in 98.
Even an amateur can fabricate a convincing order.
So, as you must see, time presses extremely. You must make up your mind. I beseech you to tell me what conditions the man we take you for would insist upon.
Stephen stared at the packet that Duhamel was holding. A fraction of his mind observed the familiar covers of the Naval Chronicle and the London Times. The rest was analysing the position, weighing Duhamel's personality and his words, spoken or implied. There was still the possibility of a trap. His instinct was against it, but his instinct was not infallible.
"The man you have in mind," he said slowly, "would in the first place require some proof of good faith. He might, for example, ask you to give him your revolving pistol."
"Yes," said Duhamel. He laid it on the table. "Take care. It is loaded."
Weighing it in his hand and looking at the ingenious mechanism, Stephen said in parenthesis, "It would be too heavy for me."
"It cocks when you pull the trigger," said Duhamel, in the same curious time out. "The barrel revolves by itself. You get used to the weight."
Stephen went on,
"He would insist upon the release of his companions, the restitution of the diamond, and immunity for the original possessor, with liberty to travel, if that should be desired."
"Your man asks a great deal," said Duhamel.
"So does your principal," said Stephen. "He asks hypothesis to put his head under the guillotine."
"Are those the minimal conditions?"
"They would be, I'm sure," said Stephen. "But you are to observe that I am speaking of some airy, suppositional being."
"I cannot engage for so much," said Duhamel. "I must refer to my principal. I hope to God there is time. Valençay and back."
"Valençay?"
"Yes," said Duhamel,
and a look of intelligence passed between them. Talleyrand lived at Valençay much of the time, and the perhaps calculated indiscretion might be a further proof of good faith.
"Would you give me back my pistol? I feel naked without it on a journey, and it would be of no use to you here or at the Rue Saint-Dominique. Major Clapier wishes to see you again this afternoon. I could not refuse without exciting comment, but we have them fairly well in hand. You will be treated as an exceptional prisoner, and you will be back here before sunset. I have given the strictest orders that you are to be here before sunset."
He looked at his pistol. Stephen gave it to him, and Duhamel gave Stephen the little parcel of English papers.
"I thought these might amuse your leisure hours," he said.
"It was only Duhamel," said Stephen,
in answer to the intensely anxious expression on Jack's face.
"He wanted to be dosed, and he has very humanely brought us these publications to amuse our leisure hours."
"Our leisure hours," said Jack, laughing in his relief. "We shall have quite a few of them, I believe. There is not much more I can do in there until we have our block and tackle. Jagiello's dear, pretty Poupette may possibly put them in our dinner basket."
he took the Naval Chronicle, and after a little while he burst in upon Stephen's ratiocination with a fine exultant cry.
"By God, Stephen, she did it! Ajax came up with the Meduse off La Hogue and beat her into mummy in 35 minutes, killed her captain and 147 of her people, Ardent and Swiftsure in sight to leeward. By God, it was worth it! It was worth running poor dear Ariel ashore!"
Stephen returned to his thoughts. More than 9/10 of his mind accepted Duhamel's words as true. Was the remaining area of doubt the effect of years and years of caution and distrust, or had it a sounder basis than mere professional deformation? As time went by, he found it increasingly difficult to believe anyone implicitly. Deformation there was, and graver deformation than he had supposed. He had been wrong about Diana, for example. He had never in his heart believed her capable of love. Of friendship, surely, of fondness, and even quite strong affection at times, but never love, above all not for him. Yet now there was the proof in the form of this glorious, loving, hare-brained action. He knew she valued that bauble above her salvation, and even more than that, she had put her head into a noose for him. He felt a great wave of gratitude and admiration warm his heart, and when once again Jack broke in, pacing across the room with a chronicle open in his hand, Stephen looked up with an extraordinary serenity in his face.
"Look at that,"
said Captain Aubrey, in a low, awed voice, pointing to the page.
"Marriages," read Stephen. "Lately Captain Ross of La Désirée to Miss Coburn of Kingston, Jamaica."
"No, no! Lower down!"
"On Wednesday at Halifax, Nova Scotia, Captain Alexander Lushington of the Royal Marines to Miss Amanda Smith, daughter of J. Smith of Knocking Hall, Rutland, Esquire." "I do not believe I know Mr. Lushington."
"Of course you do, Stephen. A great beefy hulk of a man, just like a bull. In Thunderer. She's not been on the North American station above 3 weeks. God help him. God help us all. Could you believe such a thing? Do you suppose it was all air, that baby?"
"Sure, it may well have been."
Jack considered, shaking his head. A great smile spread over his face.
"Lord," he said, "I do not know I've been so relieved in all my life. Lord, I shall have such a go at that slab. I shall clap on to it so hearty now."
He disappeared into the privy, and could be heard scraping with almost reckless vehemence until their dinner came. They searched the basket the moment Rousseau was gone, and nothing did they find. "Never mind," they said, "the double sister blocks coked would come with their supper."
"So this is a soupe anglaise," said Jack, when they reached their pudding. "I've often wished to see one."
"Not quite an orthodox soup, however," said Stephen. "This forms no part of the accepted receipt."
He held out the ladle, and in it there lay a little tinned iron pulley of the kind used for washing lines. Fishing produced its pair. Jack looked at them with wonder.
"How that dear good young woman can conceivably have supposed that these could act as double sister blocks, I cannot tell. Look, look at their pins. Young Yellow, you must signal that what we need is purchase upon purchase. Never mind the coking, so the sheaves run double. But the pins must be at least 5 times as thick as there."
"You forget, sir. I told you she should not be here this afternoon, nor tomorrow," said Young Yellow.
And in a defensive tone he observed that as far as he could tell, the pulleys were very like what Captain Aubrey had drawn.
"Why, I am no great draughtsman, it is true," said Jack, "but I did put a scale, you know. Is that the barber?" he asked, turning his ear towards the door. "I should like to be trimmed, but I do loathe being trimmed by a deaf mute. Don't you find it make your flesh creep, Stephen?"
"I do not," said Stephen, "and that is no barber, but Rousseau and his soldiers to take me away. I expected them. Do not be concerned," he said, feeling for his ampulla. "Unless something unexpected should occur, I shall be back at sunset."
"Before sunset, without fail," said the captain,
as he signed for his prisoner. For on this journey the captain and lieutenant were his only companions. Little unexpected occurred as they drove through Paris, although Stephen did see Dr. Baudelaure as they passed the Hôtel de la Motte, and there was little unexpected in his arrival at the back side of the Rue Saint-Dominique. The only change was that soon after he had been put into the barred waiting-room overlooking the stake, The door opened, and a man was thrust in so roughly that he fell sprawling on the floor. Stephen helped him up, and he sat wiping the blood from his face and hands, muttering to himself in Catalan,
"Oh, Mother of God, Lady of Consolation, save me!"
They fell into a conversation, and the man, speaking heavily accented, hesitant French, told a very pitiful tale of the persecution he had suffered for the cause of Catalan independence. But he was a clumsy fellow, an obvious plant who had not even learnt his lesson well, and Stephen grew very tired of him and of his little bladders of gore. The interrogation that followed was of much the same mediocre quality. Major Clapier produced two people, one a sweating minor zoologist, the other a decayed official, who almost in Fauvet's very terms deposed that Dr. Maturin had offered to carry messages, had spoken disrespectfully of the Emperor, and had solicited a fee. A clerk from Beauvilliers Hotel followed them, and quite truthfully stated that Dr. Maturin had desired him to change 50 guineas for Napoleon's. This, said the Major, as impressively as he could, was a very grave offence indeed. Dr. Maturin now stood convicted on all hands, and as a man of sense he must see that the only way of escaping the penalty was cooperation with the authorities. Nobody seemed to believe it, however, and Stephen was hoping that he might be dismissed, when after a brief silence a sharp-looking man on the left spoke up.
"Can Dr. Maturin explain how it came about that a lady should offer the equivalent of at least 1,000,000 for his release, if neither he nor she is a political agent?"
Stephen at once replied, "Can the gentleman possibly conceive of any political agent yet weaned, capable of such enormous folly, mortal to himself and to his colleague?" They looked at one another.
"Then what is the explanation?"
asked a captain.
"Only an insufferable coxcomb could reply," said Stephen. "Is it possible that the lady, such a lady, could be enamoured of Dr. Maturin's person?"
cried an officer. The first honest, sincere amazement that had been heard in that room.
"It is improbable, I must confess," said Stephen. "But you are to consider that both Europa and Pasiphae loved a bull, and that history teems with even less eligible companions."
They were pondering upon this. The atmosphere was almost relaxed, and Stephen had received veiled looks of wondering respect when a man came in and, leaning over Clapier's shoulder, spoke to him in a low, urgent tone. The Major looked up, with a startled expression, and hurried from the room. In 5 minutes he returned with a companion, and his face was pale with furious emotion. But Stephen had little time to study Clapier's face, for his companion was Johnson.
"That is the man," said Johnson at once,
and they both looked at Stephen with the bitterest personal hatred and malignity. Clapier stepped forward and said in a low tone, barely under control,
"You killed Dubray and Pontécanet."
Stephen thought he was going to strike him, but Clapier mastered the impulse and cried,
"Take him to the cells! Take him to the beehive cell!"
The beehive cell was deep in filth and ooze, and perhaps it owed its name to the hissing swarms of bluebottles and flies. It was bare, apart from some iron rings let into the wall, and Stephen stood through the ensuing hours by a barred opening at the level of the paving outside, the paving of the execution ground, loathsome great flies settling thick upon him, their bellies cold. Standing there he saw the sun go down. The sky turned nacreous, so that the roofs beyond the court took on the sharpness of a silhouette. The pallor deepened to an exquisite violet. The outlines vanished, lights appeared, and in an uncurtained room beyond the stake he saw a man and woman eating their evening meal. They ate, awkwardly, because they were holding hands, and at one point they leaned over the table and kissed. There were also stars, a sprinkling of small dust, and one great unwinking planet that sloped diagonally down the sky by imperceptible degrees, slanting past a gable before it was lost behind the roofs. Venus, perhaps. He felt the ampulla in his cheek. Undying mortal sin, except by casuistry. And although he had long thought prayer in time of danger indecent, prayers sang in his mind, the long hypnotic cadences of plain chant imploring protection for his love. The sound of boots at last. A light round the door. the grind of keys, and in the sudden glare, the renewed buzz of innumerable flies, he made out a sergeant's guard. They marched him back to the room where he had been questioned, and there, his eyes accustomed to the light, he saw a general officer, his aide-de-camp, the deputy governor of the temple, and the original figurehead colonel, now pale with anxiety.
"Is this your prisoner?" asked the general.
"Yes, sir," said the governor.
"Then take him back to the temple. Colonel, you will report to the secretary's office at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning."
It was a silent drive. The governor seemed worn, anxious, old, depressed. The aide-de-camp was preoccupied with his sword knot, which had caught in the carriage door.
"There you are, Stephen," cried Jack. "There you are at last! By God, we've been so—"
Stephen held up his hand and stood for some moments with his ear to the door.
"Listen, Jack," he said when the ancient silence had returned. "Is it possible to expedite matters at all? Johnson is in Paris. He has identified me."
"Is he, though?"
said Jack, and picking up the candle, he strode into the Jakes. He had everything ready for the coming of his purchase, of blocks stouter than those which had come with their dinner, everything but the breaking of their furniture, whose wood must provide the necessary chocks and wedges, and even that he had already prepared with deep, hidden cuts made by one of Poupette's knives nicked into a saw. The massive cross-stones of the privy lay bare, loose in their beds. Their free ends were still concealed by masonry, carefully arranged, but this masonry could be swept away in a moment, and the long, deep slabs only waited the application of a mechanical force to raise them. With the blocks he hoped for, it would be a fairly easy task to swing them silently in, one after another. He had a good hold-fast in the two lintels, and the line, though thin, was immensely strong. Even with what he had, it was not impossible.
"Whip upon whip, double rove might do it," he said. "It all depends on the pins."
He took the pulleys out of his pocket and looked at them again. The axles upon which the little wheels revolved were not above 3/16 of an inch across. They would have to sustain a very great load, and in all likelihood they were no more than soft iron.
"Lord, what pins," he said. "What landsman's pins! But at least the sheaves are strong, and the shells don't signify."
He called to Jagiello to hold the candle, and as there was not room for three in the little recess, Stephen sat on the bed and watched them. Jack was a big man, but he moved quickly, neatly, working fast with sure, knowing hands. He was extremely reluctant to cut the line, both on principle and because silk was a treacherous stuff to splice, and in time he had woven the whole into a spider's web, an extraordinarily intricate piece of rigging with cunning knots, stoppers, and beckets, the whole designed to concentrate two men's strength on the raising of the left-hand side of the farther slab. Although he was never still, to a watcher his work seemed endless, needlessly finical, obscure. At last he checked over the whole array to make sure that all was set up with the correct tension throughout, and that the resultant motion came true for a perfectly vertical lift. Then he backed out, took their best stool, broke a leg into short lengths, and split them.
"Now, Stephen," he said, "pray go in there, kneel by the crosspiece, and if it rises, whip these under it."
Stephen crept through the web and took up his post. He heard Jack say,
"Clap onto the fall, Jagiello. Haul after me, keeping time. Handsomely now. Handsomely does it."
Lines in all directions tightened, straightened. The quadruple strand above Stephen's head came down to his nose in a general and musical sound of stretching. The little wheels, clear in the candlelight, revolved. The strain came on, gradually stronger, stronger. The musical sound mounted, and still the strain increased.
"Handsomely, handsomely," murmured Jack,
and with a sighing groan the great crosspiece rose 3 inches, half clear of its granite bed.
"She rises," said Stephen, as he thrust wood into the gap.
The whole assemblage of lines began to vibrate, uttering the strangest quivering sound in that silence, and the stone sank back, crushing the wood.
"Something is wrong," called Stephen.
"Belay,"
said Jack. He came into the privy, took the candle, and said,
"Yes, the pins have gone."
They looked at him with appalled faces.
"I shall have to unship all this," he said. "They are not snatch blocks, you see."
At 1:30 the hour he had the wretched little pulleys free. By midnight he had driven out the broken pins and replaced them with a steel tail of a file struck off short.
"They ain't pretty," he said, "but they may answer. I shall reduce the pull to the power of 3 to spare the thinner one."
The weaving once more, into a slightly different pattern this time, and before the distant clock struck 1, he said again,
"Clap on to the 4.
Again the whole complication of lines straightened, stretching fiddle string taut. But this time the little wheels gibbered and squeaked as they turned, and the network trembled uneasily. It gave little impression of strength. Yet as the tension rose to such a pitch that Stephen felt all must very soon give way, he saw the slab heave gently up, up and up, and he filled the space with wood.
"It is clear this end," he called.
"Belay," said Jack.
He came and looked keenly at the stone.
"Very well," he said. "It is very well, and if the pins hold, we shall do it. But I've been thinking. My plan was to walk the slab inboard each end in turn, but that means shifting the perches each time, and even if the pins hold, I doubt we can do both slabs much before dawn. Yet if we raise and lower this left-hand end, while you wedge the other, first with a cold chisel and then with stone, the right-hand end must pivot clear of its bed and fall free. The only thing is the noise of its fall. It would save some hours. It would spare the pins. But there is the noise. What do you say?"
Stephen considered.
"I have heard a good many pieces fall from the tower where they were working in the day," he said. "Then again, the place is almost empty. We have scarcely had a night patrol this last week and more. I think we should risk the noise. Show me what I must do."
Jack showed him, changed the angle of the lift, and returned to Jagiello.
"Handsomely, handsomely," he said.
And now the stone rose in a deliberate, even movement, at much the pace of a second's hand. Stephen placed his wedges under the right-hand face, said,
"Lower away,"
and the descending stone crept, grating sideways across its bed. More wedges in the upper, the horizontal gap.
"Pull now," he said,
and as it rose, so the slab also continued its sideways motion, creeping towards the edge of vacancy. Up, down, up, down, and still the sideways movement, the wedges growing larger every time.
"It is about," he began,
but he had not time to say, "to go," before there was a void where he had been staring. No stone, nothing but night air below the candlelight, and a great twanging web of lines above his head, skipping up and down. Silence for a heartbeat, and then a most shocking crash below, a shattering roar that seemed to fill the room, the whole tower. They stared at one another, never moving until, for some reason, Jagiello blew out the candle. Time passed. Saint Theodule's struck the quarter, repeated it. No other sound at all. At length, at great length, Jack whispered,
"Strike a light,"
and first Jagiello and then Stephen endeavoured to do so.
"What a couple of lubbers you are, to be sure,"
said Jack, showing a certain testiness for the very first time.
"Give it here."
He took the tinderbox, struck hard, blew on the living spark, lit the candle, and inspected the gap and the line.
6 inches more and a thin man could slip through," he said. "With the next we should be well away. But this time I shall pudden the bite with Jagiello's shirt to prevent it from chafing."
Once more the whole system changed place to bring the hoist over the inner stone, and once more Stephen watched them. Now that the gate to freedom was half open, he could no longer control his heart, and as the long process ran its course, he felt exasperation, impatience, impotent frustration rise to an almost unbearable pitch. He was confident that the half-demolished, encumbered moat would present no difficulty, and that once they were clear of the temple, they could lie up safely in any of the half-dozen refuges he knew. All this, if only they could begin to move. From there he could get into touch with La Motte and Valençay. He was as nearly as possible certain that Duhamel's proposal was genuine, but even so it would be better to be out of his power before making the final arrangements. In any case, there was no question of remaining in the temple another day with Johnson abroad. Quite apart from the question of Clapier's personal revenge, the value of the American connection was such that he would certainly sacrifice the prisoners, taking them from the temple by main force if need be. He could easily justify himself after the event. Only too easily. and he would surely act soon. Dawn was the usual time for such measures, or a little before it. But then again, what would be the effect of Johnson's arrival on Valençay? An absurd question, for if Valençay's plan succeeded, there would be no point in any American connection, no point at all, and no concessions would be called for. It was Diana's position that tormented him. Again and again he asserted that with La Motte's protection, her wide and influential acquaintance, and her political nullity, she could not be in danger, particularly as he was convinced that Johnson had only just arrived. And again he replied that he was only reassuring himself, that his conjectures had no solid basis. To avoid at least some part of this intolerable, incessant arguing to and fro, he collected their few possessions and heaped them into a cloth bundle. He even fed the mice that had come out from under their door, quite amazed.
"I think that will do," said Jack at last.
They had long since been speaking in natural voices.
"But we shall have to heave hearty this time. The angle is not so good, the multiplication less. I hope to God the pins bear it. Yagyello, wrap a handkerchief round your hands. Stephen, carry on."
Now Stephen had something real to do. Now just beneath him lay a rectangle of the free knight. He squatted there, his pale eyes glittering, his cold chisel and his pile of wedges at hand. And as the full strain came on, Jack and Yagyello grunting as they heaved, it occurred to him that his strength, such as it was, would ease the perilous load on the pins. He straddled the crosspiece, clasped his hands beneath it, and hoisted until the stone cut into his arms on either side, until his sight was blurred with the pounding of his heart, and until he felt the slab give a releasing jerk and yield.
"She rises," he said in a gasping croak,
and skipped free to set his wedges with intense, blundering activity. Jack saw him and smiled. He also saw the door, the unknown door, the mouse's door, swing wide. Four men, with a lantern.
"Good evening, gentlemen," said the leader.
"Jack, do not move," cried Stephen,
for he and Yagyello were upon their spring, as dangerous as tigers.
"Gentlemen, good evening. Pray walk in."
He stepped forward, and fell into the free knight up to his waist. Jack and Duhamel leapt across and plucked him out, each by a hand. They hoped he was not hurt.
"Not at all, I thank you," said Stephen, mopping his shin.
It gave him an extreme, though superficial, agony.
"Gentlemen," he said somewhat sharply, "please to state your business."
"You will not remember me, Dr. Maturin," said the first man, advancing. "Danglars. I had the honour of meeting you when I was attached to the suite of Monsieur de Talleyrand Périgord during his embassy to London, and I believe we have several common friends."
"I remember you perfectly, sir," said Stephen, "and of course I recall His Excellency with the greatest esteem. I had the pleasure of seeing him a little while ago. Neither of you has changed at all."
This was not quite true as far as Danglars was concerned. He was now but an aged beauty, and even by lantern light the rouge showed plain on his intelligent, lively, but ravaged face. On the other hand, Stephen did have an affectionate admiration for the Bishop of Autun, or the Prince de Bénévent, as he was now styled. A pillar of falsehood, a prodigy, a phoenix of duplicity, but excellent company, and by a certain standard, quite sound.
"You are too kind," said Danglars,
with a turn of his person that reminded Stephen of La Mode, who was in fact one of their common friends.
"I see you are busy," he went on, "but perhaps we might have a word together. You will excuse us," he said, bowing to Captain Aubrey and Yagyello.
"By all means," said Jack, returning the civility.
And glancing beyond him, Stephen observed that Danglars' companions were Duhamel, of course, an officer whose cloak only partly hid a very splendid uniform, and a man in black whose face, in spite of an eye-shade, he connected with the Foreign Ministry, the upper reaches of the Foreign Ministry. They walked into Yagyello's room with the candle, now very low, and sat in the window-seat.
"Duhamel has told us your conditions," said Danglars. "We agree on all points but one. You require the restitution of the stone, the Blue Peter, but the stone, alas, we cannot produce immediately. But here is a pledge of its eventual restoration."
He brought out an episcopal ring set with a huge amethyst. Stephen looked at it with some curiosity, but not much liking. He did not seem pleased, and he did not reply. "On the other hand," Danglars went on, "we can produce the stone's owner, ready and indeed eager to travel, as you put it." His voice was urgent, ingratiating, uncertain. Stephen still did not answer, but turned the amethyst over and over in the candlelight.
"And as for compensation," said Danglars, more confident now, "I have drafts here on Drummond's." "No, no," said Stephen, "that would complicate matters, and I have always avoided complication. Tell me, what guarantees do you offer?"
"We three will go with you to the cartel at Calais, and cross to England if you wish. Our life, or at least our liberty, will be in your hands. You may carry what weapons you choose."
"Very well," said Stephen. "My companions come with me, of course."
"Captain Aubrey and young Apollo?"
"Just so."
"Certainly."
"Then let us go."
As they walked back, Stephen limping, Danglars said pleasantly, nodding at the dislocated Jakes,
"I am concerned that you should have had so much trouble, but nothing could serve our purpose more prettily. Wonderfully apropos, a perfect alibi. This way, by the door."
"Captain Aubrey, Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen, "we will go with these gentlemen, if you please."
Politeness over precedence at the open door, locked behind them, then down and down the spiral staircase, a long passage, a courtyard they had never seen, a wicket with two dark figures that stood aside for them to pass, then the street, wonderfully open and ordinary. Two coaches and two horses led. The man in black and the cloaked officer mounted. Jack, Duhamel, and Jagiello stepped into the first coach, Stephen and Danglars into the second, and they drove off at a steady trot through the quiet, dark streets, a warm, covered night, down towards the river.
"Where do we take up the lady?" asked Stephen.
"Why, at the Hôtel de la Motte," said Danglars, surprised.
"Indeed? You are as sure as that?"
"Oh, yes," said Danglars,
and it was clear from his voice that he was smiling.
"She has not been molested?"
"Not really. There was an American gentleman, a newly arrived American gentleman, inquiring for a compatriot with whom he thought she might have some connection. But she has not been molested."
On the Pont au Change, Stephen said,
"It is understood, is it not, that she will believe this release to be entirely her own doing?"
"Certainly," said Danglars.
"Certainly."
And he added, "Anything else would be folly from our point of view." The Rue de Grenelle, and already a few market wagons, one piled high with flowers. The Hôtel de la Motte, and Diana was waiting for them there in the courtyard, slender under her hooded cloak, with a group of men-servants by another coach loaded with trunks. Stephen leapt out and limped up to her, she running to meet him. They kissed, and he said,
"Dearest Diana, how profoundly I thank you! But I have cost you the Blue Peter." "Oh, how happy I am to see you," she said, holding his arm. "Be damned to the necklace. You will be my diamond."
Then,
"Stephen, you have torn your stocking. Your leg is all covered with blood." "Sure, I just barked my shin. Tell, how do you do, my jewel? I heard from Bordeloque that you were not quite well." "Stephen," she said, looking at him under the lamp, "I did not do it, I promise you. I kept my word. I took great care. I was amazed. Amazed. Dr. Bordeloque said it could not be helped, upon my honour."
"There was no help for it," he said, nodding. "That I know very well. Give me your hand, put your foot on the step, and we are away, with the blessing."
Away and away, with the sky lightening on the right hand of the road. At Beaumont-le-Château they changed carriages in a great silent house far down its avenue of limes. Duhamel seemed to be the somewhat incongruous master of the place, and he led them in to shave, to put on civilian clothes, and to breakfast. As they were trying on their coats, Stephen said,
"Listen, Jack, you must know that Diana gave her great diamond to a minister's wife for our release."
"Did she, by God?"
cried Jack, motionless, one arm in his sleeve.
"Handsome! Damn my soul, if that ain't handsome. But Stephen, she was so pleased and proud of it. Nothing finer in the tower, a king's ransom. How can I thank her? She was always a thoroughbred, but this. Sophie will be so eternally grateful. So am I. Upon my sacred honour, so am I."
He ran into the high, gaunt, echoing room where breakfast stood on a trestle table, seized her in his powerful grasp, kissed her heartily on either cheek, and said,
Cousin Diana, I am so grateful. I am proud, oh, so proud to call you kin, as proud as Lucifer upon my soul. God bless you, my dear.
In their new coach, a vast machine with 6 horses, he said she must live at Ashgrove Cottage. Neither Sophie nor he would hear of a refusal, and as they sped through Picardy, they talked of Stephen at length. He was now in the leading carriage with Danglars and Duhamel, in close discussion of the documents he was to carry and to comment upon in London. Any plan for bringing Buonaparte down had his wholehearted support, however wild it might be, and this was very far from wild. He made suggestions for rendering it more acceptable to English feelings, but these were changes of tone or of shading, never of substance. He thought the whole proposal admirably well conceived. Keen, intelligent, analytical minds had been at work, and he cordially hoped they might succeed, that they might meet with equal intelligence in London and at Hartwell. The same minds had worked out their route and the details of their journey, and although he had seen what could be accomplished by efficient organization when urgent intelligence had to move fast, he had never experienced anything as smoothly effective as this. Only once, 3 miles beyond Villeneuve, was there the slightest delay, when a horse cast a shoe. Otherwise they rolled across Picardy, rolled across Artois, with never an unforeseen pause. They passed columns of troops, many of them mere boys, all marching north, long lines of cavalry remounts, a siege train, ammunition and victualling wagons, field artillery, and every time the road was cleared well before they swept by. Stephen knew very well that most French victories had been founded on brilliant staff work, and it was clear that the conspiracy included some eminent staff officers. Yet he sometimes felt that this perfection could not endure, that some senior general commanding an important post might require explanations and confirmation from Paris, or that some other faction that valued Johnson and his government should send after them, or, worse still, use the semaphore telegraph whose towers he saw on every hill. But he was mistaken. They ran into Calais at high water, with the cartel, HMS Oedipus, in the harbour, ready to sail on the ebb, and there was even a moderate offshore breeze.
"You will have a comfortable voyage, at least," he said, for it had been agreed that Danglars should accompany him, if only to make everything doubly clear to his cousin Blacas and to the titular king. "That ship, or rather brig, is a particularly fine sailor. A good, dry, weatherly seaboat, as we say. Furthermore, the ocean is placid."
"I am glad of that," said Danglars. "The last time I crossed I was very dangerously ill. I was obliged to lie down."
Apart from smugglers, the Channel knew no vessels more discreet than these cartels. They moored in a discreet, shielded part of the harbour, and when they belonged to the Royal Navy, as did the Oedipus, of course, they were commanded by unusually discreet captains, often quite senior men temporarily detached for the purpose. Jack, sitting in the window of the private house where they were waiting to embark, was therefore surprised to see William Babington on the quarter-deck, obviously directing proceedings. For Babington had served under him as a midshipman and a lieutenant, and although Jack knew he had been made commander into the captured Sylphide, Jack had in fact written many letters and stirred up his friends to that very effect, Babington still seemed to him remarkably young for such a position. But, young or not, Captain Babington understood the meaning of the word discretion, as well as any man in the service, and when his passengers, English and French, came aboard, there was no hint of recognition in his correct civil reception, no hint on either side. He directed a midshipman to take Captain Aubrey, Dr. Maturin, and the lady to his cabin, the foreign gentleman to the gunroom. This being done, he looked fore and aft, and in a creditable imitation of Jack's quarter-deck voice, he roared, "All hands unmoor ship!" The Oedipus cleared the wharf under forestaysail and jib, with her topsails on the cap. She hoisted home her yards in the fairway and ran past the North Buoy, wafting very gently and discreetly through the crowd of fishing boats and coming to the outer roads in a little over half an hour. Here Captain Babington let fall his courses and some pretty severe remarks about the sloth of the midshipmen at the larboard gaskets, a sloth that foretold the ruin of the navy within a very short lapse of time. He had just uttered this prophecy, which he had first heard from Jack at the age of 12, when a tall shadow fell across the deck, and turning he saw the original prophet himself, looking nervous, apprehensive, uneasy, timid. A striking sight for one who had gone into action with Captain Aubrey as often as William Babington. "Shall we go below, sir?" he asked, smiling uncertainly.
"Why, I believe I shall take the air for a while," said Jack, moving aft to the taffrail. "It is rather hot down there."
"Carry on, Mr. Somerville," said Babington,
and he joined his former captain by the ensign staff.
"They are at it, hammer and tongs," said Jack in a low, private voice. "Hammer and goddamn tongs! They might have been married this 12 months and more." "Dear me," said Babington, appalled.
The yards were braced just so. The Oedipus was heading for Dover over a quiet, gently rippling sea. Her deck was almost as steady as a table, and now that all was coiled down and pretty, there was scarcely a sound but the wind in her rigging, the distant cry of gulls, and the water slipping down her side. They were standing not far from the cabin skylight, and in the comparative silence they distinctly heard the words,
"God's death, Maturin! What an obstinate, stubborn, pig-headed brute you are, upon my honour! You always were!"
"Perhaps you would like to see our figurehead, sir," said Babington. "It is a new one. In the Grecian taste, I believe."
Oedipus might well have been in the Grecian taste, if the Greeks had been much given to very thick paint, an insipid smirk, eyes fixed in a meaningless glare, and scarlet cheeks. The two captains stared at the image, and after a while Jack said,
"I was never any great fist at the classics, but was there not something rather odd about his feet?"
"I believe there was, sir, but fortunately they don't show, he being cut off at the waist."
"Though, now I come to think of it, was it not his marriage rather than his feet?"
"Perhaps it was both, sir. They might go together, and I seem to recall something in Gregory's Polite Education to that effect."
Captain Aubrey pondered, staring at the dolphin striker.
"I have it," he cried. "You are quite right. Both marriage and feet. I remember the doctor telling me the whole story when we lay alongside Jocasta in Rosia Bay. I do not mean the least fling at your figurehead, still less your brig, Babington, but that family was not really quite the thing, you know. There were some very odd capers, and it ended unhappy. But then the relationships between men and women are often very odd, and I'm afraid they often end unhappy. How do you find your martingale's answer, lead single like that?"
In the cabin, Diana said,
"Stephen, dear, how can you possibly expect any woman to marry you when you present it as a mere matter of expediency, as something forced upon her? I only said that Johnson was in Paris, that the English ports were closed against you as an enemy alien, and that you had no choice," said Stephen, looking miserable, confused, and upset. "I have been trying to get that into your thick head this hour at least, Villiers."
There you go again," cried Diana. "Surely you must know. Surely you must feel that any woman, even a woman as battered as I am, must look for something more romantic in an offer of marriage. Even if I were to marry you, which is totally inconceivable, I should never, never do so after such a grovelling, such an utterly mundane and business-like proposal. It is a question of common good manners or ordinary civility. Really, Maturin, I wonder at you."
"Yet indeed, Diana, I love you dearly," said Stephen, in a dejected tone, looking down.
"The whole point is that we save a bobstay," said Babington on the forecastle. His eye lifted to the upper rigging, and directing his voice aft, he called, "Mr. Somerville, I believe we may set to gansels."
Bosun's piping, cries of,
"Lay aloft, lay out, let fall, let fall,"
and the Oedipus spread more canvas with a smooth celerity that warmed her commander's heart, conscious as he was of Jack Aubrey's gaze. The captains were back at their martingales and dolphin strikers when a tiny, shrill young gentleman, Babington's sister's son, came running forward and said,
"Uncle William, she wants you in the cabin."
Then, recollecting himself and blushing, he pulled off his hat and said,
"If you please, sir, the lady in the cabin's compliments to Captain Babington, and would be glad of a word with him at his leisure. And Captain Aubrey, too, sir, if you please."
They hurried aft. The marine sentry opened the door with a significant look. Significant of what? And they walked in. Babington at once saw that his passengers were friends again. Rather solemn, but strangely contented, holding hands like a happy country pair. Instantly his spirits rose. He cried,
"Oh, Mrs. Villiers, how delightful to see you! Lord, Doctor, how very welcome you are!
What will you take? I have a whole crate of champagne. Tom there, rouse out the champagne.
Captain Babington, my dear, said Stephen. When do you expect to be in Dover?
Oh, in 2 or 3 hours, no more, with this breeze and tide.
Why, he said with a grin, was you to shin up to the main truck, you would see the white cliffs from here.
Then there is not a moment to lose. I have a service to beg.
I shall be only too happy.
Delighted.
I desire you to marry us.
Very well, sir, said Babington. Tom there, the prayer book.
William, said Jack in an aside, do you know the drill?
Oh, yes, sir. You always taught us to be prepared for the unexpected, you remember. It comes before the burial service. Thank you, Tom. Now pass the word for my clerk, will you? Ah, Mr. Adam, the log and the proper certificates for a marriage, if you please. Note the time, and stand by to give the responses. Now, sir, who gives the lady away?
A moment's hesitation, and then Jack, catching Diana's eye, cried,
I do, who's next of kin, and most uncommon happy and honoured to do so, he added.
Then you stand here, sir, if you please, said Babington, taking his station behind the mahogany table and checking pens, paper, and inkpot. Doctor, have you a ring?
I have, said Stephen, producing the amethyst.
Babington placed them, opened the book, and in a clear sea officer's voice, without the least hint of affectation or levity, he read the service through. Jack listened to the familiar, intensely moving words. At Till Death Us Do Part, his eyes clouded, and when it came to Do You, Stephen, and Do You, Diana, his mind ran back so strongly to his own wedding that Sophie might have been there at his side.
I now pronounce you man and wife, said Babington, closing the book, and still with the same gravity, but with great happiness showing through it, Mrs. Maturin, dear doctor, I give you all the joy in the world.
This concludes the reading of The Surgeon's Mate, copyright 1981, by Patrick O'Brien. This book was read by Simon Vance. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Georges Borchardt and was produced in 2002 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too.